Welcome to Optimal Health for Busy Entrepreneurs, the podcast for busy and high-performing entrepreneurs and leaders who are looking to create more energy and optimize their health while upgrading their brain and personal performance with precision. I am your host, Julian Hayes II. I've been involved with health and performance for over a decade. This podcast was created for the high performer who is unapologetically ambitious, the one who moves at a fast pace and operates with an edge, the one who wants to become superhuman. Nothing here is fluff, gimmicky, or feel good. I have little to no interest in simply helping you improve your life. I want to help transform it. By listening to this podcast, expect to have a body that feels just as good as it looks. Expect to possess a swagger and style that gives off an infectious vibe. Expect to command the stage or any boardroom you walk into with your executive presence. And lastly, expect to become your most enhanced self so you can live a limitless life. Now, let's get to the show. To another episode of Busy Entrepreneurs. I'm your host, Julian Hayes II, back at it again with, as always, another fascinating guest, a fascinating superhuman, a guy who you're going to be able to relate to in his health story. We are talking about a very important system in our body, the cardiovascular system. We are going to get into building a superhuman heart. This is a subject that's near and dear to my heart. Heart disease is the number one killer, I believe, in the U.S. right now. And it's been the champion. It's had the championship belt for the last 30 years. So clearly we're not doing something right. And to my knowledge, it's like 88% of Americans aren't metabolically healthy, which is crazy to believe. That's a huge number of people if you think about how many people are in the United States. And so I'm talking with Dr. Philip Avedia today. He is a cardiothoracic surgeon who's on a mission to empower patients to take back their health and, quite simply, to stay off of his operating table. He's also the host of the podcast, Stay Off My Operating Table. It's a great branding, but it's also, more importantly, a great message that's much dearly needed. So I want to welcome the Rebel MD, Mr. Philip. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Julian. Thanks for having me on. I'm really excited to have this conversation with you and your audience.
Awesome to hear it, man. And let's dive into it. Let's get a little bit of your origin story. So were you one of those people who knew they always wanted to be a physician as a little boy or later on?
Sure thing. I did always know that I wanted to be a physician, specifically that I wanted to be a surgeon. And to be honest, I don't really know why that was. But when you talk to my parents, they'll tell you, you know, as long as they can remember from when I was very little, whenever someone would ask me what I wanted to do, I always said I wanted to be a surgeon, even though I don't think I truly knew what that was. I think my decision, you know, my leaning towards going into medicine was probably influenced somewhat. My older brother was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes when he was young and I was young. And, you know, I saw everything that kind of went on around that. And I think subtly, you know, that was the influence that got me thinking about going into medicine. And why I had a leaning towards surgery, I really still haven't quite figured out. But as I went through all my medical training and, you know, surgery is always what called to me and always what I enjoyed doing and found most interesting. And that's, you know, ultimately what led me to be a heart surgeon.
Yeah. And so what's one of the most surprising things about being a heart surgeon that probably the general public wouldn't even think about?
Well, you know, I guess ultimately what I come down to, the most surprising thing about being a heart surgeon is it's sort of like any other job. You know, you do very similar things over and over again, except every, you know, situation is a little bit different. So you know, oftentimes being physicians, being surgeons in particular, gets compared to being a pilot. Whereas, you know, hopefully the vast majority of the time when you're flying that plane, things are very boring and you're just doing, you know, kind of what you always do. But, you know, you need to be prepared that if all of a sudden you find yourself, you know, like Sully trying to land the plane on the Hudson River, that you've, you know, had good training and you know how to do that. And, you know, in medicine, I think it's similar to that. You know, every time I go into the operating room, I hope to have a boring heart surgery. But the reality is that every patient is different and every situation is different. So, you know, there are always things that come up that can make any day all of a sudden very challenging. And I'm glad, you know, that I had good training and now lots of experience, 15 years as a heart surgeon, to be able to deal with that.
Yeah. And so now to dive into you personally, and as I was doing a little research on you, I came across that you were at one point morbidly obese, which is just interesting because a lot of times you wouldn't think that, okay, this guy's a heart surgeon. He sees people in really bad conditions and he's trying to rehabilitate their health and everything. How would someone with all this medical knowledge have trouble maintaining their weight? So was this always something that you struggle with?
Yeah. So, you know, again, from childhood, I was always overweight, and that was despite, you know, doing what, you know, my parents and I were told we were supposed to be doing. You know, we ate very much in line with the dietary guidelines. As I mentioned, I had a brother who was a type 1 diabetic, so that meant that we did not have sugar in the house. We didn't eat sugary cereals. We ate low fat, you know, skim milk instead of regular milk. We had margarine instead of butter, and all of those things that, you know, we all heard were the right things to be doing growing up. And I was also very active as a child. I played sports year round. You know, I'd ride my bike. I would walk everywhere. So very active childhood, eating what were supposed to be the right foods. And despite that, I was obese as a child and got more obese as I went through, you know, college and then medical school and then my training, you know, to become a surgeon. I think people know that, you know, medical school and training, you know, what's called residency to become a, you know, you whatever type of physician you end up being, whether it's a surgeon or you know, a medical doctor, you know, that's a very difficult time period. You're in the hospital long hours, you're eating hospital food again, which we think would make us healthy. But in retrospect, it clearly wasn't having that effect for me. And, you know, in some ways, being a physician, I think, worked against me because I believed what I had been taught in medical school, that the way to lose weight was to eat less and move more. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the U.S. dietary guidelines, low fat diet, that's what I was taught was the healthiest way to eat. And there were a number of times in my life, you know, during medical school and afterwards, that sort of worked a little bit. I would, you know, put my mind towards losing weight. I would, you know, track calories and go to the gym and exercise a lot. And I would lose some weight, like, you know, many people in your audience probably can relate to, but I would end up gaining it back and more. And I probably went through that cycle, you know, 3, 4, maybe 5 times. And I found myself, this is about 5 or 6 years ago, now, you know, morbidly obese. I was, you know, probably about 275 pounds at the time. I was pre-diabetic. And I spent all day, you know, taking care of patients with heart disease. And a lot of them were obese, but some of them weren't, you know, a lot of diabetic patients. And I realized that I was going to end up on my own operating table. But I was at a loss as to what to do. You know, I figured this is just a genetic problem. I considered weight loss surgery, what's called bariatric surgery. And I was pretty much at a loss. And I was fortunate to come across sort of an alternative theory of why we get obese. And that came from an author and a journalist by the name of Gary Taubes. And he had written a book at the time called The Case Against Sugar, One of his earlier books was called Why We Get Fat and Good Calories, Bad Calories. And Gary was the invited lecturer at one of the medical meetings I was attending. And, you know, Gary talked about, you know, the influence of sugars and carbohydrates on obesity. And this was something I had never heard before. Didn't hear it at all in medical school. And it made a lot of sense. And I read his books and I started doing, you know, low sugar, low carbohydrate diet. And I had great success. And now here we are 6 years later. I've lost over 100 pounds. I've maintained that weight loss. And through my own personal journey, I came to realize how important, you know, carbohydrates are part of it, but the overall concept of metabolic health, I came to realize how important that was, not only for weight management, but for most of the chronic diseases we face, including heart disease, the disease I dealt with every day of my career and never really understood what the true cause of it was.
Yeah. So I guess a good place to start is for maybe a few of the listeners who aren't, they hear this word metabolic health, right. But maybe, you know, what exactly is metabolic health? How do you define it?
Yeah. So, you know, the simplest way I explain metabolic health to people is when you are metabolically healthy, your body is properly handling the inputs that you give it. And that comes mostly in the form of the foods that we eat. And so when we eat, you know, there are a couple of things that are supposed to happen with that food. Some of that food gets immediately turned into energy to kind of fuel our day and all the activities we do. Some of that food goes towards building and rebuilding our tissues. You know, all the cells in our body are constantly turning over. We're hopefully trying to build muscle and things like that. So, you know, you need to have the building blocks for that. And finally, we're supposed to store some of this energy in case we're in a situation where food isn't available. And throughout our history as humans, throughout our evolution, there were lots of times when food wasn't available. In our modern environment, it's very rare that food isn't available. So there are a couple of problems that end up happening. One problem is that the specific types of food we're eating, you know, our bodies aren't used to handling those types of foods, so they don't process them correctly, and we end up storing all this energy that we can no longer tap into. And then we really don't give our bodies opportunity to tap into the stored energy because food is always around us, it seems, for the most part. So those are two things that have led to us having poor metabolic health, which now means that our body isn't properly processing, you know, the inputs that we're giving it. And that leads to lots of problems down the line.
You hardly ever hear, like, the overall healthcare system, just mainstream at least, talk about metabolic health.
Right.
And kind of like you mentioned, it pretty much is like a puppet master that's going to have its strings attached to nearly every chronic disease out there. And even just in general, even our weight. So wishful thinking that for the healthcare system to kind of reverse this and start to bring this more in there, or are we just going to have to start looking outside the system even more to doctors like yourself?
Well, you know, ultimately, I do hope that the system can come around to this. And I think there are a growing number of physicians like myself who are coming to understand this. You know, one of the problems with our healthcare system today is that it is so focused on treating the diseases that result from poor metabolic health. So poor metabolic health leads to things like high blood pressure and diabetes and heart disease and Alzheimer's disease and cancer. And our medical system has become very focused on doing what we can to treat those diseases and minimize the impact of those diseases on people's lives. And we almost got so good at doing that, that we lost focus on the first step, which is, can we prevent these things from happening? And that is what I think metabolic health, you know, that's the promise that metabolic health holds. And I'm hopeful, you know, through the efforts that I'm doing and the physicians that I interact with who are doing similar things, that we can refocus that discussion. We can you know, get the messaging out there that you can remain healthy. And it shouldn't just be a matter of trying to manage the diseases you have. Your focus should be prevent those diseases in the first place. Or if you already have the diseases, realize that many of these diseases are reversible. Mm-hmm. And the only option, you know, it's not the only option to treat them with medication. If you address your metabolic health and you improve your metabolic health, things like diabetes and high blood pressure can be reversed.
Yeah. And so speaking of metabolic health and indicators of that, a common one that we all know is, of course, when we think of poor metabolic health, we think of somebody that is just obese or overweight. Right. But as I've had a few friends, even family members as well, who on the outside, they just look thin. But then they go to get some blood work and they're surprised that their biomarkers are all sorts out of whack. And so what are some... how do you assess someone's metabolic health? What are some like assessments that maybe someone could do today? Some things to keep in mind.
Right. Yeah, definitely. And you know, you mentioned something that's very important that people need to understand, that obesity does not, you know, not being obese does not guarantee that you are metabolically healthy. Up to 40% of people who are normal weight or even underweight can be metabolically unhealthy. Being obese makes it very likely that you are metabolically unhealthy, although there is a small percentage of obese people who are metabolically healthy. So preventing obesity is a good way, is a roundabout way to sort of improve your chances of being metabolically healthy. But unless you're specifically looking at your metabolic health, you're not going to know if you're metabolically healthy. So in order to look at metabolic health, there are five measures that we use to assess if someone is metabolically healthy. The first one is your waist circumference. So you take a tape measure just above the level of your belly button, best to measure it first thing in the morning when you wake up. And if you are a man, you want that to be less than 40 inches. If you are a woman, you want that to be less than 35 inches. The next measurement, again, you can do it at home, although, you know, commonly gets checked at the doctor's office, is your blood pressure. And first of all, if you are taking medication to lower your blood pressure, that is already an indication that you're not metabolically healthy. If you're not on medication, you want your blood pressure to be less than 130 over 85. So top number less than 130, bottom number less than 85. The final three measures of metabolic health are all, you know, blood measures. You need to get some blood work checked. Your glucose level, your fasting blood glucose level, so the amount of sugar that's in your blood when you haven't eaten for approximately 8 to 12 hours, and you want that to be less than 100. And again, that should be without needing medications to lower your glucose. If you've been diagnosed as diabetic, again, you've already, you know, have one of the markers of poor metabolic health. And then the final two measurements both come from the cholesterol panel, very commonly checked these days by most physicians as part of a routine physical. But the two numbers we're looking at are actually different than the number that most people focus on. So we want to look at your HDL cholesterol, what's called your good cholesterol. And as it, you know, is implied by calling it good cholesterol, the more of that you have, the better. And so if you are a man, you want that to be over 40 milligrams per deciliter is the unit we use here in the U.S. And if you are a woman, you want it to be over 50. And the last number we look at is your triglyceride level, which is another measurement that's on that cholesterol panel. And that you want to be lower and you want it to be under 150. So those are the five measures that I believe it's vital for everyone to know and everyone to be tracking those measurements. Officially, if you have three of those five measurements that are not in the healthy range, you have what we call metabolic syndrome, and that puts you at very high risk for developing things like diabetes and high blood pressure and cancer and heart disease. But even if you have one or two of those abnormal, it's a warning sign, you know, that you're headed in the wrong direction. And as you've mentioned, you know, during the introduction, 88% of the adults in the United States are not metabolically healthy. That means that they do not meet all five measurements. So the flip side is only 12% of adults meet all five measurements of good metabolic health. And like I said, you know, if you don't measure, the first problem is that a lot of people don't know if they're metabolically healthy or not. Mm-hmm. Their doctor might even have, you know, has all that information in front of them, but they don't put it together, you know, in the way that we should and say, you know, you're metabolically healthy or you're not metabolically healthy.
Okay. And I'm curious also about heme A1C and fastin insulin.
Right.
Now, so I guess if I'm thinking those five parameters, is that basically like a basic, it's like just an entry level to like, and then like if you're more into like optimization and performance, then you would start to add in maybe the heme A1C and fasting insulin?
Yeah. So hemoglobin A1C is basically a reflection of your average glucose over the past 3 months or so. So it's, you know, got an advantage over your fasting glucose level because your fasting glucose level is just, you know, one spot in time you're looking at. So the hemoglobin A1C sometimes, you know, gets substituted for the fasting glucose or, you know, is an additive measure to check on top of that to make sure that, you know, over time you're maintaining good glucose levels. And I think the fasting insulin test is probably, you know, one of the most important blood tests that people can get. And it's rare that physicians order it. This is one of those tests that you're going to have to specifically ask your doctor to check, or, you know, you can go order it yourself. It's actually a very inexpensive test. You know, there are websites out there that you can get it checked for like $8, $9. But we don't use it routinely in medicine for whatever reason. And the reason that I think the insulin is so important is we know that if, you know, you look at people who develop high blood pressure and heart disease, for instance, we know that 10 years prior to them developing the heart disease, their fasting insulin level will be elevated. And if someone checks it, then you can, you know, intervene, you can make the changes to prevent that from happening down the line. But unfortunately, we don't check it. And the other problem with the fasting insulin level is even when we check it, the normal lab value for a fasting insulin, depending on what lab you get it checked at, the upper limit of the normal is considered to be somewhere around 20 or even, you know, up to 25 or 30 at some laboratories. And the reality is that in order to be healthy, that number needs to be under 10. Probably ideal is under 5. But under 10 is probably acceptable and puts you at kind of low risk for progressing to metabolic disease. So I think the fasting insulin level is a very important lab. I check it with all of my patients. It's not one of the official criteria for metabolic health, but I think it's a great, you know, test. And like I said, it gives you that information before you develop the problems, before you develop the disease, and you can intervene and prevent those problems from occurring.
Yeah, I could probably count on one hand the amount of people that I dealt with who, when I, you know, mentioned this to like their, and I've seen their recent labs that they've had the heme A1C and the fasting insulin. And so it's definitely, and it's very inexpensive, like you mentioned. It's like super cheap.
Yeah.
To do.
Yeah. And, you know, it's like I said, it's just that earlier checkup that people can get. You know, and I liken all of this to, you know, you have many entrepreneurs in your audience, obvious, you know, they understand financial issues. And if you went to your accountant and you were wondering how your business was doing from a financial standpoint, and all your accountant told you is, well, you haven't bounced any checks, so you're doing fine. You know, no one would accept that. We know that, you know, if you get to the point that you're bouncing checks, there's obviously been problems for a long time in how you're managing your finances. Yet that's kind of what we do in medicine. You know, if you don't have high blood pressure and you don't have diabetes and you're not obese, we say, okay, you must be doing all right. But the reality is that things can be going wrong for a long period of time before those problems occur. And if we're looking out at the proper metrics, we can identify those problems and head them off before they get to that, you know, bad point where you now are diagnosed with a disease. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And another thing I want to talk about now is cholesterol, some of the myths around that. I'm maybe like almost half through listening to the cholesterol myth, which is a book. I forgot the author's name, but it's pretty good so far. And I think, I don't know where it started, but we hear this thing of that your cholesterol levels is an indicator for heart disease, correct?
Right. Yeah.
And then is this where they start to use statins? But to my knowledge, doesn't statins have a lot of drawbacks as well? Is that?
Well, you know, any medication has side effects. You know, that's something we need to admit. So how we got to the point of cholesterol causing heart disease is, you know, kind of a long and involved scientific story. But, you know, basically there were some studies done early on. The most famous is what's called the Framingham Heart Study, where they looked at literally the whole population of Framingham, Massachusetts. And it wasn't originally actually designed for heart disease specifically. It was kind of more of a general health study. But, you know, they were checking all of these things and seeing what people got sick with. And what they noticed was that on average, people who ended up developing heart problems had a higher cholesterol level. At that time, they were really only measuring total cholesterol. And so this is what's called an epidemiologic or an associational study. So all we know is that people have higher cholesterol and people have heart disease. It doesn't tell you that one causes the other. And in fact, you know, just based on that, it could be either one. Heart disease could be causing high cholesterol, or high cholesterol could be causing heart disease, or it could be some third other factor that causes both high cholesterol and people to have heart disease. So that's the problem with those types of studies. And much of the science that led to the belief that cholesterol was the primary cause of heart disease, you know, come from those type of studies. Then, you know, now about 30 years ago, statin drugs came out. And statin drugs lower cholesterol. Specifically, they lower LDL cholesterol. And there were studies done where they gave people who were felt to be at high risk for heart disease statin medications, and they saw some lowering of heart disease. It's not as much of an effect as we get led to believe. And, you know, the benefits of being on statin medications are not as much as they're led to believe. And I'm not saying that they have no benefit. It's just that we don't have a real honest conversation around that. But more importantly, I take a step back and I say, you know, when you look at the data from those same type of studies, like the Framingham Heart Study, having an elevated cholesterol level, specifically an elevated LDL cholesterol level, puts you at about a 1.4 times the risk of someone who doesn't have an elevated cholesterol level, LDL cholesterol. Mm-hmm. When you look at those other two cholesterol numbers that we mentioned around metabolic health, HDL cholesterol and triglycerides, if you have a low HDL cholesterol level or you have a high triglyceride level, it actually puts you at higher risk for heart disease than having just an elevated LDL cholesterol level. About double the risk is associated with those two numbers. And most importantly, if you look at metabolic health, what we call insulin resistance, we measured insulin before, we mentioned it before. Insulin resistance puts you at about a sixth to 8 times percent risk of heart disease than just having an elevated LDL cholesterol. So what I focus on, what I try and get people to focus on, is let's go after the big thing, you know, that we know has a clear association. And if we can fix your metabolic health, mm-hmm. and we can improve your insulin resistance, it is not actually clear in that setting that LDL cholesterol contributes to the risk of heart disease.
Yeah. If you think practically, that makes sense. It's the big rock instead of one little thing. And it's basically, when I think about metabolic health, I think about, and I mentioned this a lot to clients and listeners, that it's a system. We got to start looking at the human body as a system where right. everything's connected, instead of treating things in just these separate silos. And that's what the metabolic health does.
That's exactly it. And you know what kind of ties it together and will help people think about it as well is you have to realize that the cholesterol is actually part of the repair mechanism for the damage that's done by poor metabolic health. So, you know, having poor metabolic health, specifically having elevated sugar levels, damages the lining of the blood vessels in the heart. Mm-hmm. The body sends the cholesterol to those areas of damage to try and repair that damage, inflammation that occurs with it. And so, you know, over time, if you keep damaging the blood vessels and more cholesterol starts to build up in an attempt to repair the blood vessel, eventually, you know, it starts to contribute to the blockages that form. And so when we looked at those blockages and we saw cholesterol in the blockages, we said, okay, cholesterol must be the problem here. You know, let's figure out how we can lower the cholesterol. But it really isn't the problem. The problem is the damage that's being done to the blood vessels in the first place from poor metabolic health. So if you can prevent that damage from being done, the cholesterol is no longer problematic. We all, you know, our bodies make cholesterol for a reason. It serves many vital functions in our bodies. And, you know, so it's hard to believe that something that our bodies make are ultimately, you know, what's going to, you know, kill us. And it makes a lot more sense. And again, the science bears this out, that it's the metabolic problems in the first place, you know, and the cholesterol is just part of the repair process. And so, again, it makes a lot more sense to me to try and prevent those metabolic problems in the first place than focusing on the cholesterol.
Okay. And so one more diagnostic tool that I'm just interested by, and it's the CAC scans.
Yes.
So for listeners out there, it's coronary artery calcium scans. And I guess the first thing is, I heard it through a grapevine. I don't remember where I've heard it, and I might be butchering this a little bit. I heard of like some runners, some athletes from like excessively marathon, like running marathons over the years, having poor CAC scans.
Right.
Like, how like legitimate is that? And like, what kind of training are they doing? And it, like, wouldn't other things be also like factored into that as well, instead of just the training? Wouldn't their lifestyle be a component of that as well?
Yes. So, you know, let's dig into that a little bit. So first of all, as you said, a CAC scan is a coronary artery calcium score. It's a type of CAT scan. It is a non-invasive test. They don't have to put an IV in you. You literally just lay in the X-ray, you know, the CAT scanner, and it takes about 5 minutes to do. And what that test does is it actually shows you whether you have calcium buildup in the blood vessels of your heart. So rather than trying to figure out your risk of heart disease based on these blood markers that may or may not have any relationship, like cholesterol, we can actually look directly at the heart and we can see if there is disease in the blood vessels. And this is an excellent test. So we know, for instance, that if you have no calcium in your arteries, you have a CAC score of zero, your risk of developing heart disease over the next 10 years or so is about 1%. And that it depends somewhat how old you are when you get the test done. But if you're about 50 years old, 10-year risk of heart disease with a CAC score of zero is 1%. So that is a lot better predictor than any of the blood markers we have. You are correct that there have been studies that have shown high-level athletes, marathoners, to have higher CAC scores. And there are a couple of theories about why that might be. You know, I think what, again, makes the most sense is, as we talked about earlier, this whole process starts with inflammation and damage to the blood vessels. And excessively exercising is one of those things that can cause that inflammation to occur. So if you're doing that on a very regular basis, you know, like marathoners need to do, you can understand that that might cause problems. But the confounding factor in my mind is one of the other things that marathon runners do is they all tend to consume a lot of carbohydrates and sugar. Everyone knows about carb loading before you, you know, run your marathon, and you got to have the big plate of pasta beforehand. So, you know, that's a little bit of a confounder as to whether it's the marathon running itself, whether it's all of the carbohydrates they're eating. And even though they're burning through those calories by doing the exercise, they're still taking in all that sugar that's passing through their system and the carbohydrates. You know, so that is a little bit of a confounder. What I always tell people is, you know, I don't tell people to stop exercising, you know, because they have a high CAC score. But I say we need to make sure that you're metabolically healthy. We need to do the other things, you know, to make sure that if you have a high CAC score, you're doing what we can do to help prevent that from becoming full-blown heart disease.
Okay. Yeah. And so, yeah, I was personally interested in that because I'm getting more into the endurance world as well, in addition to lifting. But one thing I have noticed with my endurance friends, also, it's the type of carbohydrates that they are consuming as well. And also, I noticed that at least some of them, I if you excessively exercise, you exercise a lot, you also have to put more time into recovery, rejuvenation.
Right.
That's one thing I noticed as well. So I wondered if my head, so if you have excess calcium, could that mean that things such as your body's severely depleted of magnesium, since they kind of go together, and could it be other nutrients as well that kind of messes that up as well?
Yeah, I think there are, you know, other factors that go into this, you know, things like vitamin K2 specifically, vitamin D. You know, our bodies are very complex. So, you know, this is another concept that I talk about a lot with my patients that, you know, it becomes very hard to start to isolate single things and say, this is what's doing the damage. This is the nutrient you're deficient in or whatever, because all these things interact. And so that's why I go back to the kind of high level concepts. You know, when I'm talking to people about metabolic health and how to maintain it and improve it, you know, just the very simple concept, eat real food is what I stick with. And I don't think we necessarily have all the information we need to really say it's one particular, you know, component of the food. But when you look at the foods that are clearly damaging to our health, the ultra processed foods, you know, whether you're vegan, carnivore, you know, paleo, anything, I think the one thing that most people can agree upon is ultra processed foods are bad for health. Now, what is it in particular in the ultra processed food? Is it the fake, you know, oils, the vegetable and the seed oils? Is it the highly processed carbohydrates? Is it the salt? You know, all of these things have been implicated, and we don't really have the science to say it's one particular thing, but the combination of them clearly is not good. And so I think the simplest thing people can do to, you know, improve their metabolic health is eliminate processed food and just eat whole real food.
And the last thing about that, is there a recommended age that you would say someone could possibly get a CAC scan?
So, yeah, you know, CAC scans are probably a minimal. We know that these things build up over time. So, you know, getting it done at any age, if you have calcium at any age, if you're in your 20s and your 30s and you get a CAC score done and you have any calcium, anything more than zero, that is a big warning sign.
Okay.
So it's never too early to get it done. The caveat, though, is that the younger you are when you get it done, if your score is zero, I would say, you know, that guarantee is not as that guarantee over your lifetime. You know, we only have the data kind of out 5 and 10 years from getting a scan done. And so if you're 20 when you get it done and you have a zero, I just tell people that doesn't mean that you never need one, mm-hmm. you know, again in your life. You have to reassess this every once in a while. So there's no real downside to getting it done too early. It's just that, you know, it's very unusual for people to have calcium in their arteries at that point in their life. So I typically recommend it around, you know, starting around 40 years old.
Okay. Okay. And the next is, let's dive into, because not a lot of doctors actually work with people in terms of like, you see them for a little bit and then that's it. But you actually are working with people with their metabolic health, nutrition wise, lifestyle recommendations, and seeing people. I looked a little bit on your site with your practice. And so how do you start to work with people when it comes to rebuilding their metabolic health?
Yeah. So the general, first of all, my practice is completely telemedicine. So I can see people from all over the United States. I'm based in Florida, and I'm licensed in many states. There are a few restrictions around that, but for the most part, I can see people from across the United States. I work with both individuals, you know, one-on-one, and I also do some business kind of group coaching, you know, for small businesses or for executive suites of larger businesses. I work with businesses as a group as well. It starts with what we've been talking about. You got to assess where you're at. So the metabolic health, the blood markers, you know, sometimes things like CAC scans, more advanced testing around heart disease risk, all of that are things that I do. And then if you're not where you need to be, we then lay out a plan to get you metabolically healthy. The majority of that has to do with the foods you're eating, but there are other factors that go into it. Things like exercise and sleep and stress and getting adequate sun and making sure your vitamin D levels are where they need to be. All of those things go into metabolic health. And so I work with people on all of that. And as I said, everything is done, you know, via telemedicine, so that it's convenient for people and it's easy for me to, you know, help them wherever they are.
And personally, what was one of the hardest parts about losing all that weight and really changing your lifestyle?
Well, you know, so this is something that people really doubt when I tell them, and it's hard for them to understand that losing the weight the way that I ultimately did it, you know, going low carb, ultimately going, for me, it's mostly carnivore, focusing on my metabolic health was actually the easiest way to lose weight. And it's, you know, been the most sustainable. We're now 5+ years that I've maintained this weight loss, which is something I had never done before. So, you know, what I tell people is being overweight is hard. I know that. Losing weight the way that you've been told to lose weight your entire life by counting calories and moving more is hard. And the statistics show it doesn't work for most people. Focusing on metabolic health is easy. And one of the other, you know, big principles that I work with people on, you kind of mentioned it before, is the systems versus goals approach, you know, Scott Adams. And you have to look at your health as a system. And you have to focus on being metabolically healthy, not on the short-term goal of, I just want to lose 20 pounds or 30 pounds, or I just want, you know, this one particular marker to be in one range. So, you know, I try and get people to reframe their thinking around, I want to be metabolically healthy. This is how I eat to maintain my metabolic health. This is the exercise I do to maintain my metabolic health. These are the stress relief techniques I use to maintain my metabolic health. And then it really does become a lot easier because you're doing the things that make you healthy. And when you're healthy, you feel better, you look better, you know, you think better. The mental clarity that comes with this is always impressive to people as well. And I think that is a more sustainable and an easier way for people to get, you know, achieve what they want to achieve.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think I heard somewhere that you have a book plan coming out at some point.
Correct. So my book is called Stay Off My Operating Table. It's being released November 11th.
Okay.
It's going to be going up for pre-sale shortly on, you know, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all the usual places. It will also be an audiobook and Kindle. So please be on the lookout for that. The best way to kind of keep up to date on that is if people go to my website at ifixhearts.co. The first thing they'll do, they'll go right into a metabolic health assessment quiz, and it marches you through those questions that we, you know, those metrics that we were talking about. And you can sign up for my newsletter when you take the quiz, and you'll find out, are you metabolically healthy or not? And, you know, on my newsletter, just once a week, I send out, you know, updates and tips and tricks on metabolic health. And shortly, I'll be sending out all the updates on my book as well.
Awesome to hear. Awesome to hear. And depending on when this episode's released and if that link's available, I will include that as well on the show notes as well for the pre-orders and everything, because it'll definitely be out before November, but probably sometime in October. Sometimes.
I suspect by the time this comes out, it will be up for pre-sale.
Okay.
And as I said, it should be on Amazon and all the other major online booksellers.
Okay. And so you kind of got into the last question of where can listeners keep up with you? I know you mentioned your website.
Yeah.
Is there anywhere else?
So social media, I'm most active on Twitter, and I'm at iFixHearts. And then, like I said, iFixHearts.co is the website. I do have an Instagram at Ovadia_heart_health. But Twitter is really my most active place.
Okay.
And all then, right. as you mentioned earlier as well, I just launched, this is, you know, a couple of days before we're recording this, I launched my podcast. It's called the Stay Off My Operating Table podcast. And that is also out on all the major podcast platforms.
Good. Good to hear. And I'm also subscribed. So listeners, go over there. And while you're listening to this, go ahead and hit the subscribe and or follow button on his podcast as well. Lots of good information coming from not only the podcast, because I listened to all of them before we got on the call here, but I also follow him on Twitter. There's lots of good information shared there as well. So I've really enjoyed this conversation. This is one of my favorite areas of the body to talk about. So I can geek out on this. So, you know, so thank you again for joining me on this conversation.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Julie. And I hope this was useful to your audience. And like I said, in the end, the most important message is know whether or not you're metabolically healthy or not, and stay off my operating table.
Well said. And so listeners out there, stay awesome, be limitless. And as always, go be superhuman. Peace.